From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, Emilio Amini is joining us to discuss the effort to develop a vaccine against the HIV virus. With 20 million victims thus far, and 24 years into the epidemic, there can be no higher priority than developing an effective vaccine. We'll be discussing the technical and social obstacles that have stood in the way of HIV vaccine development. Then, later in the show, I'll be providing a commentary on a teacher's strike that occurred in my community, and report on how things are going in my medical office with the implementation of the new Medicare prescription drug plan. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The Nation's Health, newspaper of the American Public Health Association, reports conflicting responses among public health professionals to the Food and Drug Administration's ban on further use of the antibiotic Baytril in animal feed. The Food and Drug Administration, a branch of the federal government, had been working on the ban for 5 years, undoing the approval it gave to the use of the antibiotic in poultry back in 1995. Baytril is chemically very similar to ciprofloxacin and several other antibiotics which have become mainstays of antibiotic therapeutics in medicine. Cipro gained attention 3 years ago because it is one of the most effective antibiotics for use against anthrax, a bacteria whose biological characteristics make it a particularly dangerous bioterror agent. The concern in the public health community is that widespread use of antibiotics, especially in agriculture, lead inexorably to the target bacteria evolving genetic resistance to whatever antibiotics are frequently used against it. One bacteria of special concern is Campylobacter, since it causes a particularly nasty intestinal infection, and antibiotics related to Baytril have been among the most effective agents used to treat the infection. Unfortunately, when last monitored in the year 2002, over 20% of Campylobacter strains had become resistant to that entire family of antibiotics. So concerned infectious disease specialists feel that the antibiotic should never have been approved for agricultural use in the first place, and that a 5-year process to get one antibiotic removed from the market after target bacteria are already gaining resistance represents a completely failed process. Public health advocates instead believe that all antibiotics used to treat human infections should be banned from agricultural use. To accomplish this, an act has been proposed before the U.S. Congress to ban 8 entire classes of antibiotics from any use in animal feed. To learn more about the bill, listeners are referred to the website keepantibioticsworking.com. On January 12th, the legislature of the state of Maryland overrode a veto by Governor Robert Ehrlich to enact a law that requires companies with more than 10,000 Maryland employees to spend at least 8% of payroll on health care or pay the difference into the state's Medicaid program. Because nearly every large employer in Maryland is already spending more than 8%, the law will end up impacting only one company, Walmart. Mia Mastin, a Walmart spokesperson, condemned the bill as the result of partisan politics in the state and threatened a partial pullout of Walmart stores from Maryland if the bill is actually implemented. A planned distribution center about to be built will also be put on hold. One of the bill's sponsors, Senator Gloria Lalla, stated her intention to see that the legislation is implemented and accused Walmart of dumping employees the company refuses to insure into the state's Medicaid system. With over $10 billion in net profits, Walmart contributes health care for only about 48% of its 1.3 million workers nationally. One out of every two Walmart workers' children are uninsured or on public assistance. Walmart employees who work less than 34 hours per week must wait 2 years before they can enroll in Walmart's insurance program. And even full-time employees only receive a contribution from Walmart for health insurance after 6 months of employment. For the year 2003, Walmart employees paid approximately 40% of the cost of the Walmart health plan, a percentage that is far higher than the national average for large employers, and also much higher than Walmart's main retail competitors. Some of the data for this story were gathered from a web-based Walmart clearinghouse called WakeUpWalmart.com. Last month, the Brazilian government relinquished $40 million worth of money that the U.S. government had targeted to Brazil for its HIV programs. The decision resulted from a requirement the U.S. Agency for International Development has begun placing on HIV program recipients. All organizations receiving money for HIV programs through the U.S.'s largest international health donor are now required to formally state their opposition to prostitution. Brazil has numbered among the three most effective countries worldwide in limiting the spread of their HIV epidemic. Their strategy has been to deal with drug users, homosexual men, and prostitutes in an honest way, providing relevant education and the resources they need to prevent HIV spread. This has included needle distribution for IV drug users, condoms for populations at high risk of sexual transmission, and efforts to deal in a non-judgmental manner with prostitutes, also providing them with the resources they need to prevent acquisition or transmission of HIV. In refusing to take the anti-prostitution pledge, the Brazilian government was not promoting prostitution, but felt that it did not wish to jeopardize the progress it had made through engaging prostitutes and helping them address the contingencies in their lives. This decision by the government in Brazil has been controversial. While virtually all the private sector and civic organizations with active HIV programs support the Brazilian government in principle, many felt that the decision to forego the aid may have been unwise since the money had been used to support such effective programs. Interested listeners are directed to the website of the Global Health Council, globalhealth.org. Coming up next, a look at the effort to develop a vaccine against the HIV virus. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. According to data from the United Nations AIDS program, approximately 40 million people are currently infected with the HIV virus, roughly 95% of them in the poor countries of the global south. Over 3 million people worldwide are dying of HIV infection every year, and over 500,000 of them are children. Since the onset of the epidemic 2 decades ago, 20 million people have died in sub-Saharan Africa alone. The number of AIDS deaths in Africa will soon surpass the 20 million people who died of the Black Death during the 14th century. and AIDS is expected to slash overall economic activity in Africa by 25%. Worse yet, the infection is spreading rapidly in Eastern Europe, the Caribbean, and many parts of Asia, particularly India and China. In 2005, 4.9 million people were newly infected with HIV, 700,000 of them children. These dire statistics provide only the most fleeting summary of the devastation the HIV epidemic has caused, particularly in Africa. Preventing further spread of the infection currently involves a tremendous burden of education and combating entrenched cultural patterns and desperate poverty. It may not be possible to prevent every girl orphaned by AIDS in the poor countries of Africa and Asia from turning to prostitution and contracting the infection herself sooner or later. Given the magnitude of the problem and the tremendous obstacles involved in controlling the infection, given the currently available resources, the development of a vaccine that can prevent HIV infection would seem to be a mandate of the highest priority. We know that it's possible. Horrible, disfiguring, and often fatal illnesses, such as polio, smallpox, and measles, have been largely eliminated from the world, primarily due to immunization. So 24 years into the epidemic, why is there still no effective vaccine that could prevent the transmission of HIV? Joining us today to explore this question and to discuss the development of an HIV vaccine is Emilio Amini. After receiving his PhD in 1980 at the Cornell University Grad School of Medical Sciences, Dr. Amini joined the Merck Research Labs and participated in studies that led to the recombinant hepatitis B vaccine, and also worked on vaccinations for hepatitis A and EBV. In 1986, Dr. Amini turned his full-time attention to the study of the HIV virus. He led the team at Merck that developed indinavir and efavirenz, two of the earliest potent anti-HIV drugs. In 1997, he became the vice president of Merck's Vaccine and Biologics Research. 2 years ago, he joined the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, known as IAVI, to head their HIV vaccine development program. The International AIDS Vaccine Initiative is a global nonprofit organization operating in 23 countries that is working to speed the search for a vaccine to prevent HIV infection. Emilio Amini, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Given that the HIV epidemic is undoubtedly the greatest public health crisis we've seen in centuries, and it's an infectious process, it seemed like a rather obvious strategy right from the time it was identified that the disease was in fact infectious in origin, that we might want to develop a vaccine to prevent the disease. And for that reason, it seems somewhat shocking and disappointing that 23 or 24 years have gone by since we've known about HIV's infectious origin, and still we don't have an effective vaccine. So I was wondering if you could describe some of the technical and scientific problems that have prevented the development of an effective vaccine.
Absolutely, Marv. The concept of wanting to develop a vaccine for HIV, as with any other infection, was there from the very beginning. And in fact, some of the earliest work that was done once the virus was initially discovered was to attempt to develop a vaccine. Now, I guess the simplest way of looking at the difficulty and why it's been so hard to develop a vaccine, I guess, is in the following way. If you consider all of the infectious diseases, or at least most of the infectious diseases, for which effective vaccines have been developed, they have one thing in common that's different than what you find with HIV, and that's the following. And in the cases of all, again, of those infectious diseases for which effective vaccines have been developed, so, you know, measles, mumps, rubella, influenza, chickenpox, hepatitis B, these are all infections in which the immune system by itself is fully capable of eliminating the infection. So, for instance, let's take influenza as an example. If you become infected with the influenza virus, the virus replicates, you get ill, and the immune system mounts an immune response that eliminates the virus, and you recover from influenza virus infection. And typically, against that exact same strain of the virus, it's very rare to get reinfected. And the reason why you don't get reinfected is because the immune response that eliminated the virus in the first place then is an effective immune response that will prevent reinfection with the same strain of the virus. Same thing is true for measles virus. In the days when, before the vaccine was introduced, when kids wound up with measles, typically they never had a reinfection with measles because, again, the immune response effectively eliminated the infection and established an immune state that protected the individual for the rest of the individual's life. Case of HIV, once the infection is established, it's not eliminated. The infection establishes a long-term persistent infection. And the reason why is that the virus has developed a series of both structural and biochemical mechanisms to protect itself against elimination by the immune response. Now, what a vaccine typically does is that a vaccine teaches the immune system to respond the way in which it would normally respond when it sees an infection. So again, let's use influenza virus as an example. A successful influenza vaccine teaches the immune system to rapidly mount an immune response to the influenza virus when the virus enters the body of the immunized individual. The host sees the influenza virus. It now has an immune response that has been primed by the previous immunization. And what happens is that that immune response then responds very rapidly, as it would normally not do. It would typically respond more slowly, but now responds very rapidly, and it eliminates that infection. In the case of HIV, since the immune response is incapable of eliminating the infection in the course of natural infection, it's not clear how one can devise a vaccine that will teach the immune response to do what it normally is incapable of doing in the case of HIV infection. So that, in short order, is what the problem has been.
And so what have been some of the strategies used to try to get around that problem, and those of you who are working on the problem?
The nature of the persistent infection that's established does reflect a fine balance and a fine interplay between the virus and the immune response against the virus. Because the virus, in addition to mechanistically and biochemically protecting itself from elimination by the immune response, also predominantly infects a central component of the immune system, what's called the CD4 T helper cell, which is the cell that predominantly orchestrates the immune system. So as a result, during the course of the persistent infection, the virus negatively affects the immune response. So you have a balance during the persistent infection, the virus essentially beating up on the immune response while the immune response tries to beat up on the virus. So by understanding what that nature of that interplay is, what researchers in the field are trying to do at the moment is to devise a vaccine that will teach the immune response to rapidly respond to a new infection with HIV so that when that balance is established between the immune response and the virus, that balance favors the immune response. So even if the infection is not prevented in the vaccinated individual, that immune response will have an advantage in mitigating and in keeping virus replication under control. Now, by doing so, the vaccine will have two benefits. There will be a benefit to the individual himself, because by keeping virus replication under control, we all know that, in fact, there is a long-term beneficial clinical consequence to the individual. But also, by keeping virus replication substantially to a reduced level, the likelihood that that individual will then transmit the infection to another person within the population is also substantially reduced.
Now, are there not a small number of people who have become infected with the HIV virus who do become immune? And have studying those people been helpful?
Well, there's actually more than a small number of people who, once they become infected with the virus, again, have a persistent infection, but have a much lower level of replicating virus during the persistent phase of the infection. And these individuals tend to have a favorable clinical course. They're still infected with the virus. They are still infectious themselves, but they can live with the virus for many years without any therapeutic intervention, and the virus is maintained at a relatively low level. And in fact, studying these individuals is a primary goal of researchers, has been for a while, continues to be, to try to understand, in fact, whether or not this is truly due to the immune response against the virus. It's probably going to turn out to be, again, a complex interplay between the virus and the immune response. I think part of the reason why at least some of these individuals have relatively low virus loads is that by chance, they were initially infected with a virus whose replication capability, or variant of HIV, whose replication capability was less than that which is seen in other individuals, average individuals, let's call it that, who are infected with the virus. Yet on the other hand, it's also clear that some of these individuals tend to mount different immune responses against the virus. So understanding what those immune responses are provides at least an important goal for researchers in attempting to design a vaccine that will at least elicit those kinds of responses.
Has the fact that there exist a large number of different subtypes or varieties of HIV virus itself, has that added to the problem attempting to develop an effective vaccine?
That's a very good question, Marvin. The genetic variability of HIV imposes potentially a significant obstacle to the development of a vaccine. As you know, HIV is highly genetically variable. The way in which the virus replicates itself, it uses mechanisms that make it prone to a large degree of genetic mutation and therefore a large degree of genetic variation. And in fact, that is the primary tool that the virus uses to adapt to its environment. Now, when that environment changes and puts pressure on the virus, such as, for instance, introduction of antiretroviral therapy. As you know, the virus, unless it is sufficiently suppressed by that therapy, virus very rapidly becomes resistant to the therapy. The largest environmental challenge, in fact, that the virus has to face in the context of an infection is the immune response to the virus. And the virus deals with that immune response by altering itself genetically so that essentially it shimmies away, so to speak, from the immune response. And that drives a fair amount of genetic variation, not just within a single infected individual, but within a population of infected individuals, because different variants, genetic variants of the virus, will transmit from individual to individual within those populations. And that imposes a significant obstacle, because even if a vaccine in the end is successfully developed based upon our understanding of the immune response against the virus, then one has to face the issue of how one can develop a vaccine that would prime the immune system to be effective against every possible variant of the virus that could potentially infect an individual.
So far, you've pointed out that the fact that there are very great technical scientific obstacles to the development of an effective HIV vaccine. But upon reviewing some of the background material in preparing for today, it's clear that those aren't the only problems. That in fact, another issue is the need to develop large-scale trials in developing countries, presumably. And I was wondering if you could explain the reason why that's important to do, and then the obstacles to doing that.
Well, eventually, Marvin, if a vaccine is developed that one believes could potentially be effective either in preventing infection with HIV or in mitigating that infection should the infection occur, then one needs to test the vaccine in populations that are most affected by HIV infection. And unfortunately, those populations are predominantly found in developing countries, particularly in the countries of sub-Saharan Africa. So in the hope that eventually a vaccine that could be potentially successful is developed, it's important to set up clinical trial capability in those populations so that one can assess initially the safety of the vaccine and then the ability of the vaccine to elicit the kinds of immune responses that one hopes would be effective. And then finally, within those same populations, to conduct what are called efficacy studies. And that is to very specifically study the ability of the vaccine to either prevent or mitigate infection in those populations, given the virus that's circulating in those populations. As you can imagine, the logistics of setting up these studies and conducting these studies in a rigorous fashion in developing country populations are rather formidable. Having said that, there has been substantial recognition in the research field of HIV vaccines for many years about the importance of establishing the ability to work in developing countries, again, among populations that are most infected by HIV infection. And in fact, there have been considerable strides over the last 10, 15 years in setting up what's called a clinical trial infrastructure in these countries and among these populations. And in fact, there's been a lot of success. It's difficult, but there has been a lot of success in setting up the clinical trial infrastructure.
And your organization is actually working on that, right?
That's right. My organization, the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, has as one of its goals the establishment of clinical trial infrastructures in countries of sub-Saharan Africa, as well as in India, and has established a number of clinical trial sites with associated clinics and laboratories, both for initial testing of potentially interesting vaccines, and also for studying the nature of early infection that occurs in these populations. And then these would also be populations that, should a vaccine actually be successfully developed, that could potentially be effective, one could test the vaccine in those populations as well.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. My guest today is Emilio Amini, head of vaccine development at the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. During the second part of the interview, we'll be discussing whether groups researching HIV vaccine have been sharing their findings, or if information has been patented and withheld from the public domain. And then, later in the show, I'll be providing a commentary on a recent strike that occurred in my community, and also on how the new Medicare prescription drug program is working out at our medical office. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On today's show, my guest is Emilio Amini. Dr. Amini is an expert on immunization and leads the vaccine development program at the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. During the first part of the interview, we discussed some of the technical and scientific obstacles to the development of an HIV vaccine. In the second part of the interview, we'll discuss some of the economic obstacles involved in HIV vaccine development. Now back to the interview. Another potential problem with developing an HIV vaccine, it would seem to me, would be the fact that the vast preponderance of people who public health practitioners would want to receive the vaccine, the eventual target population, the vast preponderance of those people have really no money, no resources. And therefore, a pharmaceutical company which is trying to decide what research areas to prioritize would really direct themselves away from HIV research, because they probably don't want to develop a product in which 95% of the target population can't afford to pay for it, yet they're going to be heavily pressured internationally to provide it. Is that not the case?
The problem that you mentioned is not a problem that's unique to HIV. It's been a problem that's been around for quite a while, for instance, with respect to malaria. It's been a problem that's been around with respect to tuberculosis. There are other infectious diseases which are problematic in developed countries, but are even much more so a problem in developing countries. The biopharmaceutical industry has obviously a lot to offer, since the vaccines against infectious diseases that have been successfully developed, the majority of them have been successfully developed by biopharmaceutical companies that have the technical expertise and the technical wherewithal to do so. It's important to understand that that expertise, that technology, must be applied as well to diseases, and particularly infectious diseases, that are specific problems for developing world countries. And I mentioned the three big ones, right, which are, of course, HIV, malaria, and TB. And what one finds is that organizations such as IAVI, which is a public-private partnership, one of our objectives, in fact, is to provide the financial incentives that will permit biopharmaceutical companies to become interested in participating, again, given their technical expertise, in the development of vaccines for diseases that are specific for the developing world. In our particular case, it's HIV. There are a couple of other foundations as well, the Malaria Vaccine Initiative for malaria vaccines, the Ares Foundation specifically for tuberculosis vaccines, and all of us develop partnerships with biopharmaceutical concerns, large or small, that have technologies that could be applied to the development of these vaccines, and we provide the ability for those organizations to participate, and they do participate.
So the plan will be to subsidize those companies for getting involved.
The plan is to provide a infrastructure, a financial infrastructure, a technical infrastructure, a clinical trial infrastructure that permits those companies to become involved in fields which are technically difficult for all the reasons that we discussed before, and not necessarily targets that have a high probability of success, and permit them the ability to mitigate the risk, at least initially.
Do you feel that the overall funding currently going into the HIV vaccine research effort is adequate?
Funding for HIV vaccines has been rather substantial, particularly in the last few years. These are large studies that need to be conducted. These are very expensive studies. These are logistically difficult studies. So, and given the devastating nature of this infection, particularly in countries of sub-Saharan Africa and now in Asia and worldwide for that matter, it could certainly use more funding. And doubling of the available funding minimally, I feel, is what would be required in order to begin to continue to make additional inroads into understanding the infection.
Now, is the goal of HIV vaccine development to prevent disease transmission to people who are not already infected? Or would another potential goal be to prevent disease progression in people who do get infected?
The goal at the moment is to develop a vaccine that will prevent infection, because in the end, one will only be able to make a significant impact on the transmission of the infection, particularly in the most affected populations, by having a vaccine that will prevent infection. Now, one can do that in one of two ways. If one can devise a vaccine that will completely prevent infection, then that's obviously the way to go. But on the other hand, if one initially can only develop a vaccine that won't prevent infection, but which will keep virus replication under control in individuals who do become infected, then such a vaccine will also have what we call an epidemiological impact, will likely diminish the likelihood that the virus will be transmitted through the population, since there is a direct link between how much virus is present in a potentially transmitting individual and the likelihood of transmission. Then there's a whole other set of potential objectives, which is to develop a therapeutic version of the vaccine that one can use to specifically enhance the immune response against the virus in individuals who have already become infected.
Is that easier to do?
Excuse me?
Would that be easier to do than totally preventing?
I was just going to say, Marvin, it's unclear whether or not that's even possible. Because remember, when the virus establishes its infection, it has a substantial negative impact on the immune response. And even in individuals whom the virus is kept under control through effective therapy, it is unclear whether or not there is a sufficient recovery of the immune response, particularly recovery in the immune response against HIV, that one can then use a vaccine therapeutically to further enhance that immune response. My own personal perspective is that it will be a particularly hard goal for therapy.
A vaccine that would prevent disease from worsening. That will be very
A vaccine that can be used in an individual who has already been infected, that can then be used to prevent further progression of the infection in that individual.
In the United States, and in actually in many other developed countries, there is actually a great deal of fear that public health practitioners often view as a problem, an obstacle itself, a fear of vaccines, of immunization in general. And there have been a few issues that have ramped up that fear, a threat in 1976 of swine flu vaccine and some issues with live polio vaccine. But at any rate, there's a great deal of fear in the United States about vaccination. And I think the smallpox vaccine, which actually does have a lot of side effects, maybe has augmented that as well. And I was wondering if a potential HIV vaccine would more likely have more side effects, such as is the case with smallpox. Or is it too soon to know that?
Well, Marvin, 2 points. First of all, with respect to a specific HIV vaccine, it's too soon to know what the side effects of such a vaccine would be because there isn't one that's been developed yet. And so that's too soon to say. However, let's talk about the issue of quote-unquote fear with respect to vaccines. I wouldn't characterize it as fear. And let's look at the success of vaccines. All right, smallpox has been eliminated. Smallpox was an incredibly devastating infection. It's been eliminated throughout the world. Polio is almost eliminated throughout the world, another devastating infection. In developed countries, there is no more measles, there's no more mumps, no more rubella, chickenpox is going away. Influenza virus infections would have substantially greater consequences for the population if it were not for influenza virus immunization. As a matter of fact, the general health in the population next, in terms of the three major public health initiatives which over the past century have made an enormous impact in public health, it's clean water, good nutrition, and immunization for the prevention of infectious diseases. I view it as a great success story.
I was wondering if you could maybe describe the HIV research establishment a little bit. Is most of the HIV funding and then most of the research itself occurring here in the U.S., or is it much of it occurring in other countries? And also, is it mostly in academic centers versus pharmaceutical companies?
No, HIV vaccine research at the moment is conducted, a fair amount of it, as you noted, is conducted in the United States. A fair amount of it is also conducted in Europe as well. And there is considerable research going on in countries that are most affected by the infection as a result of programs that have been set up by academic institutions and by governments both in Europe and in the United States in those countries. And as is true for all very important research endeavors, a fair amount of it is conducted by academic investigators. But biopharmaceutical concerns have both large and small and are participating in research.
The project you're working on to develop an effective HIV vaccine, at least from my point of view, would rank really high right now in terms of overall worldwide health priorities, in terms of research. Another fairly major one that got a lot of publicity a few years ago is the Human Genome Project. And a lot of publicity came up in regard to that effort in terms of whether it was going to be patented and be restricted to profit-seeking private enterprise. And I was wondering, has there been any concern, and is your organization or others taking action to be sure that the effort to find an effective HIV vaccine, that all that research remain in the public domain so that other researchers can learn from what's already been done?
Well, Marvin, the importance of sharing intellectual property, as it's called in this field, is in the forefront of the consciousness of a lot of people involved in the field, particularly granting agencies involved in the field. I will tell you that my own personal experience has been such that institutions involved in HIV vaccine research, individual scientists and involved in HIV vaccine research, and even the major biopharmaceutical companies understand the public health importance of what's being done here. So that intellectual property issues, even though they have not been eliminated, are being dealt with. And I hope that I will continue to see a openness with when it comes to the sharing of intellectual property that's critical to the sharing of technology and thoughts and ideas that will advance HIV vaccine development.
So you're saying that thus far it's patenting of research or discoveries in this area has not prevented the free flow of information?
That's right, Marvin. I haven't seen any hindrance in the free flow of information as a result of intellectual property issues in this field. You know, on that issue in general, it is remarkable how open this field is. And it is remarkable how the participants in this field, from governments to granting agencies to individual scientists, all recognize the absolute importance of what it is that we're all trying to do in terms of the development of an HIV vaccine. And I think we also all collectively recognize that economic hindrances, intellectual property hindrances are not things that we should let get in the way of the effort. The technical and scientific aspects of what we're trying to do are difficult enough without having to deal with these others. And I think we all recognize that.
Turning to drugs used to treat HIV infection, even though we've been hearing about the issue of making antiretroviral drugs available in poor countries, we've been hearing about this for years. It's probably a decade. That problem really hasn't been solved, and it's still an issue, the affordability of HIV medications. So I want to ask you in regard to, if you folks succeed in actually developing an effective HIV vaccine, is that going to be affordable to people in the poor areas such as sub-Saharan Africa?
I think what you'll find, Marvin, is that the world will do what it needs to do in order to make it affordable. See, there's a big difference between therapy and vaccines. The problem with therapy is that therapy has to be used every day for the life of the infected individual. So you can imagine that the cost, and I think even more so the logistics, of delivering therapy to areas of the world where the infrastructure for delivery is difficult is a pretty formidable obstacle. One of the advantages of a vaccine is that if a vaccine is well designed, one does not have to deliver it continuously and every day. One delivers a vaccine once, maybe twice, maybe three times to an individual, and it will then provide lifelong immunity to that individual. And that's one of the reasons why vaccines have been so successful in eliminating infectious diseases, even in countries in which the infrastructure is poor. It's been done with smallpox. It is close to being done with polio. It is close to being done with measles. And there's no reason why it can't be done with HIV as long as the vaccine is successfully developed with the right characteristics.
And your organization is actually actively involved in that issue, are you not?
And IAVI has, as one of its goals, the worldwide establishment of policies and methods that will support the access of a successfully developed vaccine, particularly to those populations in the world that are most in need of the vaccine.
What websites are available for listeners who'd like to learn more about the HIV vaccine issue?
Marvin, there are a number of websites, and I will direct you specifically to my own organization's website because it has links to all of these others, and it's probably the most comprehensive website, which captures the state of the field, both scientific and technical, as well as from a social policy and advocacy perspective. And the site is IAVI.org. That's IAVI.org.
So one final question I have for you, Emilio. What is your gut feeling about HIV vaccine? Do you think that within the next 5 years we'll really have a good candidate that's likely to really work?
Marvin, I can't tell you, and I usually make it a policy not to put a time on how long this will take. The only thing I can say is that even though we are, as a field, not at all certain as to how long it will take to successfully develop an HIV vaccine, what I can tell you is that the effort, again, given the enormity of the problem and the expanding nature of HIV infection throughout the world, it's a goal that we have to continue to pursue. A metaphor that I like to use is the metaphor of, you know, Christopher Columbus when he initially was making his way across the Atlantic Ocean. Quite frankly, the only thing that he knew, at least thought that he knew, was that there was land somewhere on the other side of the horizon. But until land was initially seen by his lookout on one of his ships, he had no idea how far away he was. And we're in the same spot right now. We're out in the middle of the ocean. We know that there is land, and we have to believe strongly that there is land somewhere on the other side of the horizon. But until we see it and until it breaks the horizon, we have no idea how far away we are.
Well, Emilio Amini, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Marvin, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up next, a commentary on some current events. First, how the new Medicare prescription drug program has impacted our medical office. And then a commentary on a recent teacher's strike that occurred in my community. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. This has been an eventful month on the healthcare scene. The biggest event was the implementation of the Medicare Reform Act. Regular listeners may remember that Public Health Radio devoted two broadcasts to this very important piece of legislation during the spring of 2004, shortly after the bill was enacted. I encourage interested listeners to check out those shows via our website, publichealthradio.org. I can assure you that those shows are just as relevant today as they were 2 years ago when they were aired. Listeners to those shows might have predicted that Medicare enrollees, and for that matter the rest of us as well, would have a hard time understanding the new program. And also that enrollees would be overwhelmed trying to decipher it and choosing among the private companies that are offering coverage. And even though many Medicare beneficiaries would be better off not enrolling in the new program at all, this is also a difficult decision, since the bill includes a penalty for those who delay enrolling in the program beyond May of this year. As we predicted, middle-aged sons and daughters have been forced to devote a significant amount of their time navigating relevant websites to help their often elderly and infirm parents figure out what decision to make. Fortunately, the media in this country have devoted a great deal of attention to this issue over the last few months. But we've seen less attention given to how things have gone at doctors' offices and pharmacies. Despite 2 years of preparation, the initiation of the new Medicare program has been nothing short of chaotic. Record-keeping by these private plans has been so poor that in many pharmacies, the drug plans haven't successfully tracked their enrollees and have therefore refused to pay for prescriptions, even though these companies have already begun receiving monthly payments from the federal government and from their enrollees. This situation has been so frequent that in at least 8 states, the state governments have decided to step in and pay for prescriptions for the poorest Medicare recipients. If this situation is not remedied quickly, this will lead to the ultimate scandal: taxpayers doling out inflated amounts of money to prescription drug plans. And then, when these plans don't come through, taxpayers then pay inflated drug prices for poor patients in their states to avert a crisis of frail elderly people not receiving life-saving prescription drugs. Back in our offices, the situation is also somewhat dire. As we go to renew prescriptions, we get calls from local pharmacies indicating that some of our patients' medications are not on the formularies of the plan the patient has enrolled in. Then when we ask the pharmacists if they know whether some other closely related drugs might be prescribed instead, they tell us that they have no way to know. All they can tell is that payment has been rejected after they've made an online submission. And for many of these companies, we have no way to find out the answer at all. Not a single one of the 40 drug insurance plans that began operating in our state had sent us a copy of their drug formulary by January 1st, when the program began. Finally, this last week, we received our first drug formulary. That leaves 39 plans to go. And only about 1/3 of these plans' formularies are even available with a time-consuming online search, even 2 weeks into the plan's implementation. But the most scandalous aspects of the Medicare D bill will receive no media attention at all, and will not be directly noticed by doctors or our patients. And that is that had the Medicare program itself simply negotiated directly with the drug companies and then provided no taxpayer support at all, the reduction in drug prices would have been greater than the support Medicare enrollees are currently receiving. The prescription price reductions the private plans are able to negotiate are far smaller in magnitude. Worse still, to get these plans to participate in this new Medicare program, the plans are receiving hefty amounts of taxpayer money. Not merely enough to pay for the drugs, but enough to cover duplicative administrative structures, redundant customer service and provider relations departments, the cost of advertising and marketing, money for hefty CEO salaries, and then enough money so that the plans can show a profit and pay dividends to investors. And since the Bush administration is simultaneously implementing huge tax cuts and foreign military ventures, the tens of billions of dollars going into this program every year will just be added on to the national debt. Since we're not actually paying for the program as we go, but instead adding its cost to our debt, when our grandchildren finally have to pay off the costs of this plan, they'll be lucky if there is enough money left over for any Medicare program at all. I defy any listener to this broadcast to argue that this Medicare drug bill is less of a fiasco than any other policy of the current administration, including the response to Hurricane Katrina. Meanwhile, in the town where my medical practice is located, Barre, Vermont, a divisive teacher strike recently ended. The city of Colchester, Vermont, also endured one last fall. In both cases, health insurance costs were the key issue. When we think about the causes of these strikes, we should all be clear that the fault lies neither with the unions involved nor with the school boards. It's instead a failure of our healthcare system. Strikes of both private sector and public sector workers over healthcare are becoming an increasingly frequent occurrence across the U.S. And among all the developed nations, strikes over health insurance are unique to the United States. In every other developed country, health insurance is granted as a right of citizenship. The taxes and premiums are worked out in advance, and they apply to every citizen and every business. It's not a free-for-all that beleaguers personnel departments, that completely frustrates small business owners, and that frequently results in strikes and other job actions. In every other developed country, health insurance for all is a given. It's not a gamble, and it's not a scramble. It was clear that in Barre, Vermont, rather than widespread support for the teachers, there was instead a good deal of resentment against them. This seemed surprising. If the teachers' union's proposal had been adopted, they would have faced a gradual deterioration in their health insurance package. In other words, what they were asking for was not an improvement in their health benefit, but a worsening. The difference between the two sides in the strike was only that the school board was proposing an even greater decrease in the teachers' health benefits. So why wasn't the community more sympathetic to the teachers? Because most of us are facing an even worse deal on our health insurance. Less freedom to choose our doctor, higher premium costs, and often huge deductibles. And a large portion of private sector workers worry that the way things are going, within just a few years, they may no longer have any health insurance at all. So it's not surprising that voters in the community are not going to be sympathetic to teachers who, under the worst case, will continue to have insurance that's better than theirs. A universal system that provides comprehensive care, like all the other developed nations have, is in everyone's interest. Everyone who has insurance through a private sector job must realize that we are now competing globally, and no country has health costs nearly as great as ours. So even if our products are better and our production is efficient, in the worldwide marketplace, all U.S. products are burdened by the outrageous costs of health insurance. So those of you who are employers and private sector workers have an interest in implementing a universal health insurance system that could put our health costs in line with other developed countries. During the year 2005, both Toyota and General Motors chose to locate new production facilities in Ontario, Canada, rather than the United States. And a major reason was the far lower cost of health benefits in Canada. In the Toyota case, the state of Michigan offered a tax incentive package that was worth more than double what Ontario had offered. For those of you who are public sector workers, whether you're a teacher or part of a road maintenance crew, you should be aware that your health insurance benefits will be eroded with every successive contract. The voters just aren't going to be sympathetic when the health insurance dilemma they're facing is so much worse than what you have. Don't expect voters with huge deductibles in their health insurance policies, or voters whose families have no health insurance at all, to be sympathetic to your plight. They're not going to be. And for those of you who are students, I'd argue that the biggest loss you'll face is not the week of school you missed during the strike, but the fact that after you reach your 19th birthday, over one-third of you will join the ranks of the uninsured. And it's predictable that some of you will not get the care you need and that it will make a difference to your health. And a few of you will go bankrupt when you're injured or become ill and can't afford your medical care. As far as I'm concerned, the cost of every one of these strikes should be counted as yet another administrative cost of the U.S. healthcare system, a cost that isn't usually counted. Each year, when economists estimate the bloated administrative cost of the U.S. healthcare system, they look at the waste involved in insurance company billing procedures, redundant quality monitoring systems, the costs involved with attempts to prevent x-rays and other procedures from happening, insurance company profits and dividends, as well as the costs of doctors and hospitals contending with these demands from insurance companies. But when the economists are calculating administrative costs of our healthcare system, they never seem to include the costs associated with the numerous strikes that are taking place all over the country. Or for that matter, the legal costs of dealing with the many personal bankruptcies that result from overwhelming medical costs. We can do better than this, much better. Let's ask the politicians to be bold and finally work for a universal healthcare system that is comprehensive and is not modeled on the dysfunctional U.S. system. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio. We'll be right back.